This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry's, a podcast from Guardian Australia. And another week with One Nation dominating the political story, either by their own actions or by the way other parties are reacting to them. An extraordinary example, one from within the coalition, to go beyond preference deals and adopt a seat-by-seat allocation deal. You take this seat, we'll take this seat. Sort of a no-compete clause, I suppose, in that. Look, it was intriguing, but it didn't go anywhere in the end, but we'll get back to it. The most intriguing now has to be the dueling donation drives. Now, Labor started this, of course, when they looked for individual donations of $27 to help fund advertising campaigns. One Nation responded with a drive for $29 from individuals and received millions. Tony, what does that tell us about not only the support that seems to be there for One Nation and all of the polls, but the level of commitment?
Well, it's completely spooking everyone in politics. We've talked about the One Nation monster now turning on Labor, but obviously the coalition are the first and early casualties of that. Tony Passon's comments I read in The Australian, any paragraph lead that starts off with, Angus Taylor's numbers man and confidant Tony Passon is the sort of story I tend to switch off, but I couldn't help but read the whole thing. My rule of thumb is, if Tony Passon is the smartest man in the party room, then you're in the wrong room. And I think that sort of demonstrated that perfectly. It was a terms of surrender, not a political strategy. They brought out their mop and bucket pretty quickly and tried to clean it all up. But it shows not just, the naked self-interest of the guy trying to save his own seat, because that is one of the first seats that will fall to One Nation on our polling modelling. But it also shows that amongst the broader coalition, they're completely spooked. The One Nation grassroots support is not to be underestimated. We see that anecdotally, but we also see it in some of our focus groups. And we hear it, through the traps, through the Liberal Party network and Labor Party network. They're getting enormous crowds, fairly young supporters, a very broad cross-section of the community. People have a very a narrow view of what the One Nation voter looks like and acts like and what motivates them. But it's much broader than people give it credit for. And there are a lot of people out there who are supporting the party who will throw significant money. They'll be volunteers. They will have more people on booze than the Liberal Party, I guarantee it. And I suspect probably more than the Labor Party.
It kind of mirrors what the Teals have been able to do, because despite the misrepresentation that the Teals get millions of dollars from a billionaire, Holmes Accord actually, he organises on their behalf, takes loads and loads of small donations and then passes them on to candidates who reflect his climate change policies. He doesn't give anything to them. The difference here is, of course, that One Nation now have demonstrated they can draw these small amounts of money from a whole lot of people, but they also get Gina Rinehart's money on top of that.
Yeah.
And her support.
They're going to be seriously well-resourced. Of course, they got public funding from South Australia, and they didn't spend very much on that campaign. And they're also going to get a lot of public funding from the federal campaign that they can sort of pretty much sort of put into their budget and still be comfortably, have some surplus left over.
I think in this case, there's talk of them using, now that they're cashed up, for billboards and radio and television advertising. I think that makes sense. They seem to get that. They know how to get an impact, a bang for your buck.
Yeah. One of my many complaints about the coalition and campaigns past is using a lot of direct mail. That's from 25 years ago. It's lost its zip. It's around $100,000 now.
Open them anymore when really they hit their little really boxes.
Yeah. Yeah, not even I do, But it's around $100,000 to do an electorate these days. One Nation are big on digital media. We've talked about this in previous weeks. They're kind of getting into different algorithms. Their cartoon animation, which is produced here in Australia, it is objectively brilliant. It reinforces all people's prejudice about the uniparty system. And I think they've worked out that they get more bang for their buck by narrow casting their message into different audiences. And they've identified their audiences very well. You can see that, the Gen X is a clear target, and they're starting to expand their map.
Yeah. Now, just back to the Tony Passon idea, Because this is something that, of course, the Liberals do, but with a coalition partner, with the Nationals, they've done this traditionally, that if you're a sitting member, you're not challenged by somebody from the other party unless a vacancy occur. Mm. So what they're actually offering, and that's why I think it rebounded so quickly and Angus Taylor was so fast to tidy it up, is that this was treating them as a coalition partner, even before they've demonstrated that they can actually win seats. Seating seats to an emerging party. And I think the other thing about it was when you have a good look at the seat of Barker held by one Tony Passon, it's clearly threatened by One Nation. So I think when he says, look, let's have a look at the seats and see who holds the best chance of holding that seat and who holds the best chance of holding this one, I think he probably have Barker in mind as one the Liberals would have the best chance to hold. Yeah.
And Barker is in South Australia, and I'm reliably told that the South Australian Liberal Party reached out to One Nation about preferences and arrangements there, as you do with every party. That's just standard operating procedure. And One Nation wouldn't even return the calls.
Mm.
So I don't know what makes Passon think that they're in the mood to negotiate or to... But more importantly, I would think, based on the research that we've done to date, there is a cost to One Nation in doing a preference deal with the coalition, because they'll look like just another political party. And their brand at the moment is they want to smash the uniparty system. And so I think they might lose votes by entering into that sort of arrangement where people just go, oh, they're just politics.
So what do the Liberals do then? Because there's still a live issue there. There's some people in the party are clearly uncomfortable about the prospect, but not all of them. Tony Abbott, it's really his call now. He's president of the party, and it is an administrative decision. It's not a decision by the parliamentary party or Angus Taylor, and he's already said he'll do it.
Well, Tony is federal president, but also co-opposition leader, which is a new model we're trialling, somewhat unsuccessfully at the moment. And, you know, there's obviously repercussions for Angus because, you know, Abbott sort of keeps on saying he's not going to do any more media, and then he does more media. It's like that character in the final scenes of Cape Fear. You know, every time you think he's gone, he sort of comes back again. So he is making it pretty clear that he's open to discussing things with One Nation, which, again, I just sort of think sends a message to voters, well, you know, why would you have a Xerox of the Xerox when you're going to have the real deal?
Yeah. Will in California has been in touch again, and he doesn't share my view that increased media scrutiny will dash One Nation's hopes. I like his quote here. Public opinion right now is very much decoupled from traditional approaches to politics. It's a good point.
Yep. Will's always got some interesting insights, and I think he's right insofar as there's a lot of counterintuitiveness about the One Nation voter. We're still learning a lot. We discussed the other week about Gina Rinehart's kind donation of a plane. Normal politics, you go, that's a problem. But the voters, as I explained, sort of say, oh, that's good. Yeah. So an outsider is getting something that the insider normally gets, evening the playing field. So there's a lot of counterintuitiveness. You would think that some of these issues will play out very poorly for Pauline Hanson. But I'm not guaranteed of that.
Yeah, well, Will went on to say that he also, importantly, he pointed to your observation as well, that One Nation is like a sort of a global, and there's a global network around, like-minded parties in other parts of the world, and they're building a sophisticated media machine, and he thinks there is a reckoning coming to Australia. Look, a lot of what One Nation does is hardly sophisticated, certainly in terms of governance, managing their own affairs. But they're starting to look like they do have a reasonably sophisticated media strategy.
Far more so than the coalition, I would argue. Mm. I think they're putting a lot of money into digital media. The coalition's still very much stuck in direct mail, as we mentioned before. And I can see, you know, if you look at some polling charts that were produced over the weekend from various sort of people in social media, the One Nation vote went from mid-teens, you know, making a difference, to doubling to where it is at right at the moment, 30, 31. But a lot of that sort of escalation in their vote occurred around, there were two infliction points. One of them was Pauline Hanson visiting Mar-a-Lago with Gina Rinehart, I think, introduced to Trump and Trump's circle. And at that point, there started being an escalation of the vote. And then, of course, Bondi was the other point. I would say that One Nation are getting a lot of external help, external campaign consultants, which is entirely legitimate, from America.
And that will build.
Yep. and I think it's incredibly effective, and that helps explain to me some of the extraordinary rise. Now, there are many mood sentiment things which is fermenting that growth, like Farage and Trump, and we've talked about it on this podcast all the time. 63% wrong direction, 56% think the next generation will have a worse life than their parents. All those things is fermenting the One Nation, but I don't back down from that. But
when you talk about, though, this international help, and if it was to become clear at some stage, and I'm only speaking hypothetically because I don't know, but that they were getting direct help from Trump organisers, that surely would not help them, because Trump is toxic in this country.
Yes, amongst One Nation voters, when you link Pauline Hanson to Donald Trump, who they have mostly negative associations of, that does suppress the vote for about a third. A third of One Nation voters.
That's a lot.
Will reassess. Yeah, yeah, it's about 10%. 10 points are their 30 points. So that brings them back to 20 points. So there is some effective messaging there. But obviously, you know, it's no easy thing to prove who campaign consultants are.
Yeah, we'll see what the future holds there. But look, when we talk about a sophisticated media strategy, they are sloppy financially. Sarah Martin, exclusively in The Guardian this week, wrote about the party over 6 years in Queensland has repeatedly failed to meet its legal obligations for running an incorporated association. They repeatedly file annual and financial reports late, or they don't file them at all. And they've never filed annual returns with the regulator since 2022. Now, this is not unimportant, because it does go to governance, and it does go to their ability to govern if they ever got the opportunity. You can't be this sloppy. You just cannot be. You've got to be able to get on top of things. And it's the same with their MPs and keeping them happy. They haven't been able to keep them happy in the past, and they've got to turn that around as well.
Yeah, managing parties and candidates is going to be a different question altogether. But I think in terms of the disclosure stuff, though, I'm unconvinced. As I said, a lot of counterintuitiveness. I know voters just go back, well, CFMEU, $15 billion, you know, or they'll find a similar egregious sort of thing with the coalition. So I don't think that works. And finding the right line and length on how to persuade a One Nation voter back home, whether it be back to the Labor Party or Liberal Party, neither side has worked out yet.
I think looking at this week, though, it's clear, and it has been clear in even before this, that it's a real quandary now for the major parties and how to deal with Pauline Hanson, and I don't think they've got a clue. To this point, I don't think they're really hitting their straps at all. I think there are those within the Labor Party who think, well, we're not panicking. I don't think they are, and they don't, because they know that at least they feel at this stage that they can't win enough seats to deny Labor government. That's their feeling. But they have the potential to almost wipe out the coalition and the Nats. So their question is, who has the greater responsibility to take them on? And what I didn't like the feel of this week was the way that the Prime Minister and others in the Labor Party went after One Nation. I don't think it felt good for them, mainly because they started fighting in the gutter and it was starting to become a bit personal, whereas I think they just simply have to focus on the policy anomalies and go harder on that.
Yep. Voters are very evidence-based, outcomes-based. So the big hope for Labor is, you know, their budget has not gone down well so far. But effectively, you know, final judgment will be on election night. There's no finish line in 2 weeks' time where an assessment will be made and that'll be final. But what Labor will be hoping is that those younger voters that are unconvinced by the budget so far will start to feel that the market is, you know, housing market is becoming more affordable for them, whether it be renting or purchasing. So there's some anecdotal evidence that people are getting rid of assets, housing assets, some more supply. So those young people with, you know, some significant savings, obviously those without savings will still be left frustrated by the system. If in 2 years' time at the election those younger people are like, well, these reforms are working and I've finally been able to get a house, then I think that will change things quite dramatically. I did read a report in News Corp the other day which said vox pops of young people who said, real estate agents in Sydney are finally returning my calls. You know, we've been looking for 6 months. They never return because they don't have to.
Yeah.
And now suddenly they're sort of calling me up randomly and sort of saying, are you still interested in buying? So, you know, that could be because of interest rates. It could be because of the changes coming in terms of the budget. But that'll be – Labor will be focusing on that and hoping that voters feel the system is now working for them a bit better.
And Labor can't lose fact of who the traditional opponent has been, right? And that is the coalition. I'm sure there are those within the coalition who would enjoy the fact that Labor is going to spend more time now on One Nation and less time on them. And I think that's a mistake. But when I talk about going on policies, it's such fertile ground for Labor. One issue that got a bit of attention this week was Pauline Hanson's pledge at Mar-a-Lago when she said committed Australia to 5% of GDP on defence spending. That's $400 billion over 4 years, $100 billion a year.
Mm.
You can't raise that sort of money without raising taxes, significantly raising taxes. And what is she talking about? Is she talking about what sort of defence equipment is she going to buy for that enormous amount of money? Does it include conscription? So you've got that going. But also, I really do think on this pretense, in my view, that the One Nation has that they look after the, you know, working Australians. That's the really vulnerable part, because Labor can say ahead of that we're the ones giving the tax cuts. We support wage rises, you never do. We give relief around petrol prices, we give relief around energy. I just want to give you a quote. This is Pauline Hanson from last year. She was on Sky from Queensland, and this is what she said. Lower class Australians, that's how she started, lower class. She doesn't call them low income earners, she called them lower class Australians. One's not on higher wages, was the way she described it. Here they are. They get tax cuts. They get health. They get prescriptions. They get rental assistance, plus, 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 she said. That's her view of, and of course she's talking about wage earners because she said they get tax cuts.
Mm.
And she describes them as lower class Australians. You know, with straight up, they shouldn't be getting this kind of assistance around tax cuts and higher wages. I don't see how that is sustainable over time when people become aware of her rhetoric around this.
But I don't think she's pitching to that audience in terms of votes. You know, she's pitching
to lower class Australians.
To lower income earners. You know, she's pitching middle Australia.
And she wants to build resentment.
Yeah.
In middle class Australia about some of the benefits. But she's talking about low income earners. They're wage earners. They're not bludgers.
Mm.
And yet she wants to build some resentment between those two, as she would call it, classes of people.
But Labor's effectively done the opposite in terms of they've pitched to generationally to Gen Z and millennials with the budget, hoping to solidify that base, which will make up around 48% of the total electoral roll, if not the next election, then definitely the election after.
But not exclusively.
So you can make the same claim about them.
But not exclusively.
Yeah,
they don't say categorically, she just did there, dismiss a whole bunch of people, just dismiss them.
Hmm.
Labor doesn't do that to any group in society, and neither does the Liberals or the Nationals.
No, but I'm just not convinced that's going to damage her politically.
A bit of blowback last week for me around when I pointed out the historic fact and the verifiable point, I think. It's a fact often used when you're analysing political analysis, and that is that there are sections, areas of Australia that are more wealthy than others, and metropolitan seats, people are wealthier and better educated, educated at a higher level than people in the country, though that gap is closing, thankfully, because they do get more access now to universities. But I made a pretty obvious point, and then I was interpreted as saying, well, I think country people are stupid. Well, I wouldn't say that because I'm from the country and I was not tertiary educated.
Mm.
And yet I don't think people educated at tertiary level in the city are any smarter than me, and I've had the experience of life, which is good. But that's a kind of interpretation. But then you get this email from Shane, who went to an elite private school in Toorak and grew up in Hawthorne and now lives in Fitzroy North. That's quite the journey.
Around the corner from me.
Right. Well, then you'll be able to help me out on this. Because Shane says it's wrong to say, as I did, that One Nation can't win city seats. Anecdotally, people are openly talking about it, and most are now saying that Pauline will get my vote, even at the local footy club. Well, I just think no seat, state or federal, that includes Fitzroy North in its boundaries will ever fall to One Nation. Do you back me up on that?
Sort of. I think I bumped into Shane at Nico's, which I'm not sure you'd understand. That's an inner north thing. Look, the Liberal Party primary vote in the North Fitzroy booth was 8.5%, I think, at the last election. So not a, it's just not what you call fertile ground. But Shane is right in so far as One Nation are expanding their map. It's not just from the regions, and I'm from Mackay. They are starting to get into those urban electorates. They're growing their primary vote. They're actually leading amongst millennials on a primary vote basis on our last poll for the Fin Review.
In what seat?
No, nationally. Nationally.
Nationally, so, but not in the cities exclusively.
Look, it's difficult to see the seats around Fitzroy falling, but his broader point that One Nation is starting to eat into Labor territory and the One Nation monster is now turning its sights on Labor is actually not incorrect. On our MRP that we published, which was all 150 seats, it showed that Labor is still holding all those urban electorates, which is, you know, the vast majority of Australia is urban
electorates.
I think
we are jumping so far ahead of ourselves to suggest that One Nation can win those urban seats. I do not think they can.
On those outer urban seats.
Outer urban, different.
There's some support there. I'm not sure it's going to manifest itself in transfer, seat transfer at the election. We're still 2 years away. They're not sort of overly performing very well. Some of those seats like Macquarie, Dobell on the Central Coast, Labor seats, they're in danger. The federal seat of Bendigo, the federal seat of Leichhardt and Cairns. But nothing really in metropolitan, you know, I would say is going to fall.
No, and can you say, based on what you see, that Labor is genuinely in danger of losing government, even beyond minority government?
No, not at this stage. You know, mostly helped by the fact that, you know, the coalition might be...
There's not even a narrow path there to a loss?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, what is it? What is that narrow path?
Well, I think if they start eating into some of those outer suburban seats where, you know, they've got a bit of a foothold in there, not enough that would sort of terrify Paul Erickson, but he'd be alert but alarmed. And, you know, I've read briefings that says that, you know, Labor are working on messages. Some of those union messages, again, that you mentioned before about, you know, workers' rights and entitlements will help those red One Nation voters come back to the Labor column. We've talked before about Greens voters being tactical, saying I better vote Labor to stop the One Nation surge in this seat. So it's difficult to see at this point.
Paul Keating once said of Bronwyn Bishop, right? When Bronwyn Bishop was emerging as the potential leader of the Liberal Party and she was going to be the saviour and bring them back to government, he said that Bronwyn Bishop reminded him of a skyrocket. You light it up, it shoots into the air and you get this burst of sparkle and light and then a dead stick falls to earth, right?
Mm.
That's what happened. Mm. She fell to earth. I'm not suggesting that's what will happen to One Nation, but I just suspect there will be an element of that because 2 years is a long time.
Yes. And whether they can withstand the search remains to be seen. But their voters at the moment, she's their wrecking ball. And they just want to take a flamethrower to the political system that has failed them, that has entrenched despondency, and they see no future for them or their children.
I'll give you another example where I think she got into real strife this week, and that was the billboard that went around was driven around Melbourne. This was not hidden on social media. It was a truck that drove around a billboard, a mobile billboard with Ditch the Witch and Jacinta Allen dressed as a witch. It was partly funded and sponsored by a Melbourne brothel keeper.
Mm.
And now, obviously, Jacinta Allen attacked that, as she should. Pauline Hanson's response when Jacinta Allen called it out was to say, suck it up, sweetheart. Now, I think that's a terrible message for anybody to send out to the community, that kind of language, somehow you've got to suck it up. Suggesting that it's not that it's acceptable, but you just don't condemn it, you just live with it. That's the way the political dialogue operates. Nowhere near good enough. Imagine the young girls in this town who hear that kind of expression from Pauline Hanson, that sort of vile misogyny or something. You just simply suck it up because that's life.
But again,
that's life, sweetheart. Well, yep, that's nowhere near good enough.
Totally inappropriate language. And by the way, there's 100 different complaints you can have about the Allen Labor government in Victoria. Why they would go to that particular slogan is beyond me. However, again, we come to the counterintuitive of the One Nation supporter at the moment. And politicians talking about themselves has never been a vote winner.
But I'm not really looking at this in terms of votes. I couldn't care less people vote. This is just outrageous. It picks up on Donald Trump, right? He's introduced this kind of vile behaviour in the United States now where it's almost normal.
Yeah.
Imagine the generation of kids who have come up over the last 10 years that Donald Trump has been on the scene and they're starting to think this is normal. And here is Pauline Hanson in this country saying that this kind of language is okay. Just suck it up, sweetheart. It's a disgrace, an absolute disgrace.
But we've been on this slope for quite some time. You know, the Victorian
Labor,
the Victorian Labor branch, of course, did that social media advertising on Dutton saying he's a monster. So this is nothing new. And you know, Pauline Hanson...
It's not in the same category.
Oh, I don't think it's what you'd call mature or sophisticated debate.
It's misogyny, straight out.
Yep, but I mean, you know, Pauline Hanson's made the same claim that, you know, she was called the same thing in 1996. So I think politicians talking about politicians, never ideal, and it just, I just think it just solidifies a perception in the electorate that they're not looking after me. They're sort of talking about themselves all the time.
Solidifies a view in the electorate that they're all capable of this sort of thing, and they're not all capable of that kind of performance. Well, I mentioned Jacinta Allen, the Victorian politics, so let's go there after the break.
Full Story is supported by EY Parthenon. EY Parthenon is the global strategy consulting practice of EY, working with CEOs, boards, investors, and governments on their most critical decisions. They bring deep sector expertise, an investor mindset, and advanced technology to bring clarity to complex challenges. EY Parthenon helps leaders make better decisions in moments of change, anticipating what's next, finding opportunity in uncertainty, and translating complex shifts into real-world outcomes, turning insight into action. For more insights, go to ey.com/au/Parthenon. EY Parthenon, transformative strategy and transactions. Solutions that work in practice, not just on paper.